ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja, starring Nathan and Nathan. Just to let you guys know, we are planning on doing a regular twofer every week. So our one that we're going to do is going to be a longer one. It's going to involve something more in depth. So like you've been seeing with the TV shows or summer previews, we may even take some time and make a longer one discussing one particular movie more in depth than just, you know,
or an element or you know, pop culture concept.
Yeah.
We've done a lot of like preview sort of shows, which are cool, but we're hoping to do some more that are a little more focused and in depth coming up. But we did this last week, kind of a weekly feature where it gives me a good chance to kind of talk about some of the new movies I've seen. They're coming out every week just as they're releasing. But we also found it's a great way to highlight lots of different things. Like this week, we're going to have a book review. We're going to cover some more beers. Nathan's got a bourbon for you. We actually have a sort of live tasting, so to speak.
So we're going to be drinking while you all are listening to us review the drink live. So I'm looking forward to that, dude. And I'm looking at these two beers and I'm stoked. I'm salivating right now. We'll get there. But right now, I just want to highlight a great bourbon for you all to try. You know, we're getting into the summer. Sometimes bourbons get put on the back burner going from winter, fall and winter into that spring, summertime. But you know what?
Poor bourbon.
Yeah, I know. Any time of the year is a good time to be drinking bourbon. The one I'm going to highlight is Michter's. And I'm gonna specifically highlight the whiskey because they do have a bourbon, they do have a rye, and they do have a sour. So we're going to specifically highlight the whiskey because to me, all of them are good, but that's the best one in the lineup. It really gives you a nice overall mouthfeel as it goes in. You've got great notes of sweet, almost caramelly coming in on the nose, and then it just finishes so smooth. There's little to no burn going in on that particular whiskey. So Michter's whiskey, check it out. It's one of my favorites. It's one of the ones that when I was working at the liquor store got very little love. And then a sales rep came in and tried me on it, and just it blew my mind. And so I started selling it to people. And that was one that I got the most rebuys on because it's relatively inexpensive.
What's the price range on
that? It's probably in that $35 range.
Okay, which is a kind of medium, even to lower price range for a bourbon.
For a bourbon, for a whiskey.
Really bat an eye at something that was closer to like 40.
Yeah, exactly. 35. So, Michter's whiskey, check it out. Definitely going to be worth your time. But Nathan, now we are, we're going to be doing our live tasting. So you brought these to my attention. So I want you to go ahead and, introduce them and we'll taste them and I'll use my expertise, quote unquote, to give some of the notes and
my supernatural drinking ability, too.
Hey.
But that probably didn't. Isn't characterizing it.
That's
perhaps tasting instead of drinking.
That's
ability.
Right. Hey, you know what? Superman can fly. I can taste beer.
I remember when they had originally announced that an Iron Man movie was coming out. No one could think of like why we'd want to see Iron Man, and someone said, "You will believe a man can drink." Mostly because he was so well known for those alcoholic Iron Man storylines. But so I give a shout out to a local liquor store called Grape and Grain, which I think is just a fabulous place. It's down in Perry Hall, White Marsh area. And one of my favorites, it has a great staff of people. My children think that going to the liquor store means getting lollipops because of the kind staff that's there. They always have a bucket of lollipops. And they're great. They're very knowledgeable about everything. Not to say that other guy I used to know that worked at the liquor store wasn't. But once you left, man, I was up in the air. And I found this place. Great selection, great prices. And I was going through, and I was actually just looking for something kind of refreshing for summer day. We actually picked up some of Yingling Summer Wheat, which actually is a nice, refreshing, inexpensive beer.
Yeah,
if you're just looking for something that's on the cheaper side, it's not a bad drink, you know, I think. But walk by their wall of kind of individual beers and ales, which is hard to kind of pass by. And they got a lot of great choices there for just a couple bucks. You can grab one of something and try. And I thought, hey, that would be really cool to do like a tasting on air. And I remember we were talking last week about picking things up just based on the label. So it's like, I'll pick up one thing that I have, I feel kind of confident about, and I'll just grab something based off the label.
Nice.
So confidence wise, last week I was on Twitter and suddenly it pops up in my feed that the Not Your Father's brand that has done the really great Not Your Father's root beer, yep. and I think Not Your Father's, then Orange Soda one too.
Ginger Ale.
Ginger Ale. Yeah, I love the ginger. I actually think the ginger ale is better than the root beer.
I agree with you.
And then they had this thing, and I just saw it was vanilla cream ale.
Yeah.
And they announced it was coming out in June. I think I even put up a Twitter post about, hey, can't wait, this should be a June tasting. And when I went in there, there it is on the bottom of the shelf at Grape and Grain. So grabbed two bottles because Jen was like, you have to leave me one. So,
yeah.
So my wife has one back to try, and we brought one out here. And then grabbed something I'd never heard of called Hobgoblin because yep. this is great sort of – and I'll put the picture on Facebook and Twitter, but this great kind of creepy looking
yeah.
art to it that reminds me of like Lemony Snicket or something.
Yep.
And
yep.
What's the brewery's like Witchwood or
Witchwood
Brewery?
Yep.
And it's a dark English ale. So yep. we have a dark English ale and we have the vanilla cream ale. And which one are we going for first?
Let's go ahead. Let's start with the dark English ale. So the Witchwood. So that's going to be the one that's darker in color. So we're going to be doing this live for you folks. So you're going to hear the sniffing. You're going to hear the swallowing.
Yeah, and send all emails regarding Nathan slurping to popcultninja@gmail.com.
That's right. So first thing, Nathan, the first thing we do when we taste something is it goes off the nose. So
really, I'm done already. I'm just kidding.
So as you're sniffing it, what notes are you kind of getting off of there? This is live podcasting, folks. Riveting.
Well, I noticed with this, and one of the reasons I picked up this particular one is I was hoping that we were getting something that was a little bit kind of creamier. So it has, and smelling it, it has sort of the same dark notes that you would have with something like Guinness.
Yeah.
But there's something else under there. There's almost a little bit of vanilla, and yep. I don't know if that's wafting off the other glass we have here.
Yeah.
But there's a vanilla hint under this that is not something you typically have with Guinness. Guinness tends to be dark so much sometimes that people aren't always a fan.
Right.
You know, it's pretty
yeah, and that's exactly what you're getting is almost those roasty malt notes that are coming off that. We talked about that malt last week or 2 weeks ago, and that's what you're getting off of that is that roasted malt. You can smell it just real nice. You're going to get that off of a dark ale, particularly an English style ale. And so then what you want to do is you just want to sip it in, and then when you swallow, just exhale through the nose. And that's going to bring out more of those flavors coming through.
And there's a nice kind of foam head mm-hmm. on the top here. It's not extreme,
right.
But it's nice. The kind of thing you would see off of like a Guinness.
Yeah, exactly. And that's going to be a little bit of that cream coming off. And so what you're getting, again, as you exhale, you get that sense coming through your nose, almost a little more mild than what I was getting on the nose. Little bit lighter bodied in terms of drinking. So, like you were saying, it's not going to be as full and rich as your Guinness. I don't know quite what to do with this one. I almost feel like I want a little more coming off of it.
Yeah, I don't. The first sort of like sip, like I say, and I think maybe because expecting the Guinness, it's not quite as rich as the Guinness.
Yeah.
It is, it's almost, and I don't, you know, it almost has the feel of if you like that, those elements, we talked about the maltiness, the sort of like a creaminess,
yeah.
but you like those aspects of the Guinness, but you're not a fan of that dark
yeah.
beer, that this is almost like, you know, I think in the last podcast we talked about the idea of something being training wheels for something
else. Yeah.
Maybe this is your
right.
Hobgoblin is your training wheels for Guinness.
And what's neat is because it's a lighter bodied, you could actually you could conceivably drink this. I mean, it's a warm night here in Baltimore.
Warm is an understatement in this particular room
studio.
Yes.
This is quite refreshing for a night like this. I could see myself drinking this bottle and not really feeling heavy or weighed down by the consistency of the actual beer.
And I'm not sure how this is typically packaged. I'm not sure if this is something you could get in a six pack form or
usually you're going to see it in single bottles.
Yeah. But it's not bad. I think it's a $2
mm-hmm.
beer, and I'd say worth it.
Yeah,
good. If you're into English ales, it's certainly nice. I don't know how striking it is. Again, between this and a Guinness, I'd probably still go with the Guinness.
Yeah.
But not bad. And definitely, if you're someone who's maybe a little bit more purveyor of those English ales and like something that's a little creamy, I'd recommend it for something a little different.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, great choice on that one, man. And they that company, Witchwood, they have several different ones that they do. They actually have a ginger beer that they do, which is pretty good. Maybe we can get that one on at some point. Maybe do a line of ginger beers because there are so many out there now.
And the packaging theory won out. So
there you go.
The packaging, not bad. I will say, beer versus packaging, I'm going to say the packaging is better than the beer.
Than the beer,
but it's worthwhile. Check it out.
Absolutely. So next we have Not Your Father's. Again, as you said, you had the original was the root beer. And the root beer's got such a great story because this dude who was a brewer out in Chicago, his mother was going through some of his old great-great-great-grandfather's stuff and found this recipe for an old-time root beer. And so all the ingredients in it are all natural. It's a straight up beer, but it is brewed with the ingredients to make it taste like a root beer. And it just blew the market away. I remember when it first hit the market, the guy who was my rep, JR, he was on these Go to 11 a few times, came in and he's like, dude, all right, here's the deal. You need to buy as much as you can. I'm going to do a tasting and I'm going to blow you out of that tasting. I was like, all right, fair enough. So I trusted him on this stuff. He knew what he was talking about. I bought, I think it was 15 cases of it. And so by the time Friday came around, we maybe had 13 left because we did the order on Thursday, brought it in. And so Friday comes around, he does the tasting, and we blew out of every single one of those bottles.
Oh, it was a huge hit.
Yeah.
Was it last summer or the summer before?
It was last summer because I remember there was a month, and it was the month going over the 4th of July where I could not get the stuff.
I think you'd get your yuppie card revoked if you didn't drink some of that last summer.
Exactly. And so then they came out after that with the ginger ale, which I agree with you, Nathan.
It blew me away. I thought that was an excellent the cool thing is they both taste like, the Not Your Father's Root Beer tastes like root beer. The other one tastes like ginger ale. But I think it's a better mixture of knowing that you're drinking something different than a ginger ale. It's not just a ginger ale with alcohol involved, which is kind of what I almost feel sometimes with the root beer.
Yes.
Like I can even make ice cream floats with the root beer.
Yes.
And it's awesome. But the ginger ale is more that melding of it's a little bit of what you expect. It's a little bit of its own thing, which to me makes it a little bit better.
Yep. And so now we're trying the vanilla cream. And, just same thing, like getting that nose on it. I mean, it
smells just like cream soda, really. In fact, I'll say this. My wife and I went last summer to Universal Studios to the Harry Potter, which would be its own podcast.
Yeah. Yes.
If we can get someone to fund us to go out and
that's right.
do a live podcast walking around Universal Studios. But at Universal Studios, at the Harry Potter world, they have butter beer, which is sort of a mix of, I don't know if it's cough syrup and cream soda, but it's actually really good. They have it frozen and hot variations, and it's cream soda with a little bit of something else going on, and that's kind of what I'm
Getting picking
off
up
of
on
this.
There.
So this is alcoholic butter beer. Good on you, Not Your Father's.
There you go.
Let's see.
Yeah, go ahead. I'll let you take that first swig while I talk it up a little bit and tell me what's going on there. What are you getting?
The first thing that I notice about this right off the bat, the thing about both root beer and ginger ale, they're very sweet. I mean, they are very soda-like. And this is actually, I don't think this is nearly as sweet as the others.
I got to agree
still
with
sweet.
You.
Like, particularly the aftertaste. Coming off, there's still that sticky, syrupy aftertaste that you have in your mind in regards to soda. You associate with soda. I don't really think, particularly off the first one here, I don't think that that's really as prevalent. And there's more the notes of it being like an ale, I think, underneath there or a beer than just a soda. Like it tastes just like cream soda at first, but it seems like there's maybe a little more.
Yeah, you definitely get a little bit of that alcohol going on in the background. So you're getting more than just your typical cream soda soda going on in there. So
I actually quite like it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that too early, obviously, to tell was my favorite or not, but I will say this. I mentioned earlier, like, doing the root beer float.
Yeah.
I think a cream soda float with this would be really nice. Because
the
problem is when you add the ice cream to the root beer, I mean, it's seriously sweet. So to have something like this,
Yeah, more of an even body to it.
Someone gets creative. I think they could have a real butterbeer recipe here there on their hand with actual alcohol. So hats off to you.
Adults.
Hats off, Not Your Father's, another good selection.
That's so, right.
I guess we'll see if it's as popular. I don't know that cream soda is...
That's true. We'll have to see. I think the one thing going for it is that the Not Your Father's root beer was definitely a lot sweeter than... It sat heavier in the stomach. And this doesn't have that same heavy set feeling to it.
No, and it even has a kind of sipping feel, which I wouldn't... Yeah. You know, again... I believe it's more distanced from soda than the other two.
Yes. Yeah. And I would agree with that. And I think, to me, this would almost go nice, just kind of sipping this, relaxing, having a nice cigar in your hand. I could picture that balancing out well at the end of an evening.
Yeah, I really like it. I'm looking forward to having some more as the summer goes on and, having it in some of those scenarios you're talking about. So
sure.
Pretty good. That's 2 for 2.
All right. Bonus, man.
Before we move on, I do want to ask you a question because I've noticed we have a lot of different these alcoholic, soda beers now popping up. And there was one I looked at last night. And now, with everything, I'm always like the Google, Google it to find out, even down to beer. There's something that's, I think it's like Best Damn Root Beer. Have you had any of this?
I haven't because
I look. Yeah, go ahead.
Part of it is I enjoy root beer, but I am not a huge root beer fan. So when it comes to buying it...
See, I'm like a root beer fanatic. So
yeah, so I think you would... I think that would probably be something that you would get into. I will say that from everything that I heard, because that was just coming into the market as I was leaving. So I haven't had a chance to sample it, and because I'm not a root beer fanatic, I'm not going to go out and buy it. I will say everything that I've heard has been positive.
It's funny because the first review I pulled up said, imagine seltzer water that someone melted a root beer flavored candy into.
Really?
And I was like, meh. So that might have been, I might have just clicked on the most rude or exacting review possible. I will say that at least as far as the place I was at, it was a couple dollars cheaper than... Yep. Than Not Your Father's, so I probably will try it at some point. But yeah, that image put me off quite a bit. You can visualize and taste that one. I was like, nah, I'm good.
Well, and if you can find a place where you can buy it in singles, that might be an option too. Instead of just, putting the money down for a full six pack, just go ahead and grab a single of it.
Watch out, you might find it in your hand next week.
Hey, I got two hands, man.
Fair enough. Yeah, we have two beers. So, guys, if you have any recommendations for us, stuff you'd like us to either try during the podcast or, off the side, this doesn't go just for beers, but if you've got movies, if you've got books, anything really. And if you yourself have made something and want to send it this way, we will be more than happy to bring it on the podcast. We're going to give an honest review of it and we'll be happy to cover it. So again, if you have any of those suggestions, you can hit us up on the Facebook page, the Twitter page, or just email us at popcultninja@gmail.com.
Perfect. So thus endeth the alcohol reviews. Doesn't end the alcohol. I'm going to sit here and drink while you talk, Nathan. So Nathan, you went out to see Alice in Wonderland or Alice Through the Looking Glass. And it's funny because you had texted me that day and we're like, hey, you want to come and watch this? And I was like, oh yeah, sure. That sounds cool. And then I think we were supposed to see the movie at 7:30 and you text me at 7:20. So where are you? And I was like, oh shoot, I have a podcast I need to do.
I think you said I'm podcasting half an hour. I was like, oh okay.
And that just came from a huge misunderstanding with me being at work and getting the message and looking at it and responding too quickly. But
be invited to another.
Hey, as long as you can keep doing the reviews, it matters not. So Nathan, go ahead and give us a summary of this movie, Alice Through the Looking Glass. First, before you go into it, let me ask you, better or worse than Alice in Wonderland?
So the Alice in Wonderland you're referring to is the 2010 Tim Burton movie, which is a direct sequel to.
Yes.
So if you're showing my hand right off, I'm going to say worse, with a few caveats. However, I will say I was not really a fan of that movie that came out in 2010.
Okay.
One of the things, if we go back just briefly to that movie, the one that came out, it was Tim Burton, but it really felt like Tim Burton light. It was very kind of gloomy looking. It had a lot of characters and creatures and stuff. And it was almost just sort of surface level based off of the Lewis Carroll novel, Alice in Wonderland. One of the difficulties with Carroll, I think, is that when he was writing this, you know, Carroll is really like a mathematician and a logician. And so as he was writing this, he brought in a lot of ideas of wordplay and silliness and nonsense, but and illogical ideas, but not in the way we think of things being silly, but really stuff that was playing off of things that were happening at the time,
right,
for his own life, or just in general logical conceits, turning them on their head. So there's a playfulness to the book that overcomes really the story elements. It's less a story, it's more about capturing a certain kind of childlike ingenuity that doesn't necessarily play when you sit there and try to think about the story, which is why the cartoon, the old Disney cartoon, kind of worked, because in that animated form, you could take these bits of nonsense and make them beautiful and pop out and have a life of their own that mirrored his wordplay in the kind of innovative animation that was happening. Like, if you remember the Cheshire Cat with the great big wide grin, they took that and basically just turned it into a Narnia kind of story, a Narnia light, where now Alice is coming to a world called Underland that she mistakenly called Wonderland as a child, and Underland is ruled by the Jabberwocky and the Queen of Hearts, who has this sort of enormous head and a little body, and she's going to get the sword and slay the dragon, and she encounters these characters as she goes along, but it's less about the whimsy and the silliness and the sort of illogical imaginative conceits, and it's just another kind of rote fantasy story. So again, really felt like Narnia light without any of the context that was going on underneath Narnia. It's just a very boilerplate fantasy story that also, the visuals were kind of muddy. It was one of the first movies out of the gate after Avatar to have 3D, and it was throwing a lot of things at you. And I think its success was basically because people had this big CGI visual feast, and then, oh, here's Alice in Wonderland, which is kind of the same thing. And it was just people going from the biggest movie of the year to another movie.
Right.
And it was the overflow, I think, is what sparked the cash. I don't think there were a lot of people out there that were really like, this is a great version of Alice in Wonderland. The biggest thing, I think, to come out of the movie was the star, who is Mia Wasikowska, who played Alice. And she's gone on to do a lot of different movies since then. And so we watch her come back into this. And so right off the bat, what you got is a sequel to a movie that I don't think was that good to begin with. It was also the movie that began the downfall, in a sense, of Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Going from being this really creative, energetic character actor and kind of hitting his high peak with characters like Jack Sparrow and whatnot, and then sliding down where he kind of coasted down with Burton down this hill.
Yeah.
And hasn't really made anything of real note or interest or zest. And now we here we are with a sequel, and he's kind of doing this weird Hatter thing that to me doesn't quite work. So that's the background on how I feel about the first movie. The second movie, Alice Through the Looking Glass, is the same name as the second book, which again is more silliness. That's where there's more wordplay. There's a lot more playing around with ideas. I think typically when pop culture gets a hold of Alice in Wonderland, they tend to take both stories and just merge them together. So the Jabberwocky actually comes from a poem that is read during Alice Through the Looking Glass. A lot of those characters show up in both stories. This movie has no relation at all to Alice Through the Looking Glass at all. There may be, again, characters, but it doesn't even attempt to lift any of the story elements at all. This is actually a very lazy movie, shockingly so in some ways, because it actually turns out to be a time travel story, almost in a Days of Future Past X-Men way, in which it's just an excuse for Alice to go back and jump through bits of the old story that we already saw in the last movie and have little adventures here or there without really doing anything new. She doesn't go to any new lands. She just goes back into the past of the character she met in the first movie, which isn't something you really want to see from, I think, from Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
So you have that element. The other problem is, so this movie is directed by James Bobbin, who a few years ago, he worked on Flight of the Conchords.
Yep.
He also did the first reboot of the Muppets movie, The Muppets, which I actually really enjoyed. I thought he captured kind of the heart of the character of the Muppets and captured all the things that I remember enjoying as a kid about the Muppets. Now, the sequel, less so, but that first reboot, I enjoyed. This, he's got a few interesting visuals. The movie is altogether brighter than what Burton was doing. But the problem is I didn't like a lot of the visual stylings of the characters in the first movie. The Mad Hatter being this weird kind of like almost like a New Orleans Mardi Gras mime kind of character. And the Cheshire Cat and all these characters are just CGI and not that interesting. The most interesting looking character is really Helena Bonham Carter's Queen of Hearts, who has this kind of big bulbous head and the little body. But then in this movie, we learn that she, you know, there's a little bit of spoilers here, but it's so bizarre, you know, that she's fallen down as a child and cracked her head and head just swelled up. I mean, that's horrifying for children. But the movie has elements that are kind of weird and off-putting without being interesting or engaging. Like, I don't mind scary elements or dark elements in a movie, and I'm going to liken this to a very underrated movie in a minute that I'd recommend. But this movie, again, the visuals are all building off the old movie, which I don't think were successful. So you have that here. There are a couple of neat ideas. All the new visuals, all the new ideas created for this movie are kind of compelling. She has to go back in time, and she uses this thing called the Chronosphere that she steals from a character who is the embodiment of time. He's actually like a clockwork man, played by Sacha Baron Cohen. And Cohen's actually a little bit more restrained than you typically see him in these movies. He's not quite good, but I think he had the capacity to be. She meets time, and she's not sure what to make of him. And the interesting idea is that she sees time as a thief when in reality, he is more of someone who is giving of himself for everybody else. So that character is intriguing, but what they do with him isn't. He kind of becomes the typical Cohen buffoon, and he chases her through time. And then there's the moment where she goes into time, into the time stream, if you will. And the time stream, and there's two ideas there that are very much what you would imagine a Victorian imagining time travel to be, where she is in her device on these two roiling stormy oceans, one above her and one below. And as the swells come up, in the swells are the visualizations of the time fragments she can visit. And so she and Cohen are chasing each other through this storm of seas. And so it's just, you could imagine a Victorian considering time to be these rolling seas that go on forever. And the swells are these climactic moments in your life. And then when the time stream is broken at one point, everything just becomes a devouring rust that sort of just takes over everything and leaves it these rusted, broken rooms behind it. I thought those were cool ideas visually, but there's almost nothing else in this movie. This movie has a story that is just a bunch of clunky bits hooked together. Right. None of the characters are very interesting. None of the ideas are interesting. Again, there's a few visuals that are nice, but to me, I just sat there and I just bounced right off the surface of this movie, so to speak. There was nothing in it that was engaging to me. I took my son Jonathan and he never does this. At one point, he covered his eyes because there's a weird moment where she wakes up back in the real world in like a sanitarium and, you know, a doctor's about to jam a needle in her face. And it's the guy who plays Moriarty on the Sherlock series. Right. So that is another element of deranged. And those elements don't mesh together. But his favorite part involved Humpty Dumpty, who kind of, you know, does his thing and falls off and cracks. And that was the only moment to me where it captured a little bit of that whimsy. And it was funny that coming out of the movie, it's the only thing my son talked about.
Yeah.
He liked the movie for the creatures, but it was that little bit of whimsy that was the closest to what Carol did. And I thought, I wonder what it would have been like if Carol had, if they had taken the heart of what Lewis Carroll had done in those books and tried to transcribe it to screen. I don't think this works at all. I don't think that it is nearly as good or even in the same, like, level as the most recent ones like Jungle Book, Cinderella.
Yeah.
The upcoming Beauty and the Beast looks decent.
Yeah.
You know, we always talk about, well, would you recommend it? I'd say no. I think that this one is actually a waste of time. But hey, good 3D.
There you go. Now, you were going to recommend a movie opposite this
one. Oh, yeah. So in watching this, there's a lot of elements that come in. I talked about the clockwork Cohen character, and also he has this army of little automatons, little men that start out as minutes, and then they become, or they start as seconds, and then become minutes, and they can build into a bigger creation that becomes an hour. And the funny thing is there's less of Carol in here and more of Frank L. Baum, who did the Oz stories.
Yeah.
And so it reminded me that years ago Disney did a movie that was actually kind of dark as well called Return to Oz, starring Fairuza Balk. It was a live-action sequel to Wizard of Oz, but one of the things was Dorothy was played by a young girl, not somebody like in her 20s or something.
Right.
So did you ever see this? It's a Disney movie from the 80s.
Yeah, I want to say that I did.
It's very strange. Dorothy, and it's dark. I mean, there are other elements where it's just strange. In this movie, I talked about Alice getting like she wakes up in the asylum and they want to treat her for hysteria. And in the Dorothy's story, Little Firouzza Balk, is getting ready to be get electroshock therapy before right. she runs away
yes.
and
yes,
ends up in the tornado that. And goes back to an Oz that has been completely taken over. All of her friends are stoned, so the characters you know are gone, and she befriends a whole new group of characters, and there's a TikTok and an automaton man that is kind of this big steam belly robot who reminded me of the characters that show up here. And there's a lot of similarities, but it's funny because whereas I think Return to Oz, even though it's not a great movie, even though it is a very weird and dark movie, had a lot of character, had a lot of its own eccentricity. Alice, even despite some of the potentially crazy ideas, it just feels like a movie that's been thrown together in a pitch meeting somewhere, and then we hurried up and got a bunch of artists and a bunch of people to work on it, and we kind of threw it together without any thought of whether or not it was really going to entertain people.
Yeah. Well, there you go, folks. Alice Through the Looking Glass. Go ahead, save your money. Wait for us to review something good and worth your time.
And this weekend, too, X-Men Apocalypse drops. You can hear yes. our review on that. Of the two, I preferred X-Men. You can check our review out on the previous podcast yep. where we go through all the X-Men movies and then review Apocalypse.
Yep. So that comes out Thursday. Well, tonight, actually.
Yeah.
Which both this will drop. Do, and yeah. Yep. So go check out X-Men. And then you've got a book that you want to go ahead and review real quick.
Yeah. We've just kind of jumped into the summer season as far as books go. Working on getting the Goodreads site up too. So go over there, check us out. You can find us at Pop Culture Ninja on Goodreads. And as I was going through the Goodreads and kind of setting up all the summer releases and seeing what was out there, I realized, and I did not at the time, realized that author Joe Hill, primarily known as a horror author and actually also known as the son of Stephen King, though he has downplayed that particularly as he can't kind of came up and he really wanted to stand on his own. And as King, to his credit too, kind of backed off and let him develop his own style and his own name. And so Joe Hill, his first few books, he did a book called Heart-Shaped Box and then a book called Horns that was actually done with a movie that yep. Daniel Radcliffe was in. Both of those books I think were interesting and they were still kind of having him find his voice. He's done a few since then. His new book is called The Fireman and I was intrigued by it because it has a lot of elements that you would be familiar with from a Stephen King story. Mm. It's another take on the apocalypse. And we've had so many takes on the yeah. apocalypse that after a while you're just tired. It's like, oh, here are zombies again. Here's an epidemic. What do we have this time? Of course, King is well known. One of his best books is The Stand, yes. which was a very early take on the apocalypse and brought in a lot of biblical imagery. It brought in a story that really fed into that kind of fear of viruses and epidemics. Before we really had the apocalypse as a popular right. genre, The Stand was kind of ahead of that. This story is interesting because it takes an epidemic that almost reminds me of something you'd see from Game of Thrones. There's this disease that pops up almost looking like a tattoo on your arm. It's called dragon scale. And this starts as a blemish on your flesh and it spreads. And mm. as it spreads, it eventually reaches a point where you spontaneously combust into a ball wow. of fire, which causes a big problem for everybody around yeah. you. It spreads rapidly, and its final result is a very violent death that causes a lot of collateral damage. So obviously you can see that very quickly governmental forces are going to want to kind of put the kibosh on this and are going to want to hurry the right. people of Dragonscale's demise along in a contained way. If we cremate them before they explode, then we hopefully can contain the spread of the pathogen. Mm-hmm. And in this story, you enter into a story where you've got this character who is a nurse and who ends up being exposed to the dragon scale very early on in the tale, in the story. And what happens through this story, which takes a lot of different twists and turns, I don't really want to get into it more than that basic concept. You've got this girl who's very resilient, who is also a very interesting thing. She's a very caring individual. She's obviously a caregiver, and she finds herself in her predicament because of her capacity right. for caregiving. She's married. She has a husband. Shortly, this is just a setup, so it's not really giving much away. Shortly after she realizes that she has the dragon scale, she also realizes she's pregnant. So this sets mm-hmm. up a story where she is trying to find a way to survive long enough
right.
to see this child delivered. And along the way, she meets one of the man that she met the night that she was infected, who kind of is the fireman of the title. He's a character who has the dragon scale himself and also seemingly has ability to control it in a way that's similar to another Stephen King story, Firestarter, where who could kind of telepathically control fire. Now, the story doesn't quite go that direction because we've set up all these elements. We have also these sort of types that chase or that are chasing the infected dragon scales because they want to burn them up. You know, there then we get a little bit of Ray Bradbury and Fahrenheit 451 and elements like that. We have the husband character make some very different but also very committed decisions, opposite of sort of what the main character Harper decides to do. And the story then moves towards her finding this community of other people who have the dragon scale. And at that point, I think the story becomes something very different in the same way that, not in the same way, but in a similar way to which Stephen King's The Stand opened up the apocalypse and then found a gentle haven in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And this story becomes more science fiction than horror. But I'll say this, despite all these elements where, you know, oh, he's Stephen King's son, so let's find the ways in which they're similar. The real reason that Joe Hill's name would be mentioned, I think, in the same breath with Stephen King is not because he's his son, but because he has the same ability, I think, that King has to tap into what freaks him out, into what scares him and what makes him a little crazy, and share it with people in a way that is very, for lack of a better word, infectious. Like you are sitting there and thinking, this stuff freaks this guy out, and he has conveyed that element of anxiety and concern. The second thing is his ability to craft characters that really feel like not just people you would know, but they do things that people you know would do.
Right.
Even the dumb, stupid things that people you know would do.
Right.
One of the things he does with, but he does a few things that are really neat. Like the main character's idol or the person, her spirit animal, if you will, is Mary Poppins.
Right.
Mary Poppins is her sort of optimistic beacon, and that seems so silly, but it becomes a real trait that this character has. This is a fast-paced book. It's a very well-written book. It's surprising in some ways in where the story goes. I'd recommend it even more to fans of post-apocalyptic, or not post-apocalyptic, but apocalyptic fiction, and fans of science fiction as much as I would fans of horror. It's a big leap, I think, for him. It's just a good read. It's a really fast-paced read, so definitely recommend it.
Awesome. Well, there's our review, guys. We're going to go ahead and close it up for the night and hope you enjoyed, and we'll catch you next week.
Have a great weekend.
Really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wang?